Hi, this is David from the Juno LIO calling in for a science check.
Hey, David, this is Mike 1.
Mike 1, sounds good.
Mike 2?
Mike 2 is good.
Mike 3?
Mike 3 is good.
Testifier 1?
Testifier 1 is good.
Testifier 2?
Testifier 2 sounds good.
Testifier 3?
Testifier 3 is good.
Mike 4?
Mike 4 is good.
Mike 5?
5 sounds good.
Mike 6?
6 is good.
Chair Mike 1?
Chair Mike 1 sounds good.
And last committee mic.
Last mic is good.
Awesome. Thanks, David.
Have a good meeting.
Call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is March 18th. State Capitol Senate Finance Committee Room. Present today, we have Chairman Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Kronk, Senator Olson. He's on other state business, and myself, Senator Hoffman. We have two items on today's agenda. First being Senate Bill 212, the number of Superior Court judges, followed by Senate Bill 227, tax compact, sales tax, oil and gas tax. Senate Bill 211, number of Superior Court judges. This is the first hearing on this bill. I invite Nancy Mead to the table to introduce the legislation, put herself on the record, and explain to the committee the need for the judges.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I am here today to introduce Senate Bill 212. I thank the committee for scheduling it and hearing why this was introduced. This is procedurally a little bit different from your other bills. It was introduced through the Rules Committee by request, and the request was made by the Supreme Court. This is unusual, of course. Usually statutes are not something that the court seeks to have changed because they are policy issues that stand within your branch of government to amend and take care of. However, the statutes do set the number of Superior Court judges, so in order to add a judge, we need to get the statute amended. Therefore, Senate Bill 212 would amend AS 2210-120, entitled the number of judges, to add one. As you can see on page 1 of the bill, line 5, the law currently says that the Superior Court consists of 45 judges statewide. We would like to make that number 46. And then it goes on to say that 28 will be in the 3rd Judicial District. We would like to make that number 29. Specifically, the court's intent is to have that new judge serve in the Palmer Superior Court, which serves the entire Matanuska-Susitna Valley. So for a little bit of context, the Superior Court, as members of this committee probably well know, is the court of general jurisdiction. What this judge and what this court handles are the felonies, family law cases, child in need of aid cases, civil cases over $100,000. We also have a trial court that's the district court. They handle the lower level issues such as misdemeanors, cases that are under $100,000 in controversy, minor offenses and small claims, evictions, things like that. So what we're talking about is handling in Palmer these more important cases at the Superior Court level. For order of magnitude, if you take the number of case filings, which of course fluctuate all over the state and in every court, it just depends on what gets filed in a particular year, but pretty steadily in Palmer, the filings have been between about 2650 and 2950 over the last 5 years. So I think of this as a court that handles about 2,800 cases per year. So the crux of the matter, why we need a new judge in Palmer, is because those judges carry the highest caseloads of any judge in the state. Last year, they were carrying 683 cases per judge. The statewide average is 458. So they have a third, again, more cases than the average Superior Court judge in Alaska. The next highest court, Anchorage, very busy, has 544 cases. So it's still above the 450 average, but it's not where Palmer is right now. And also, by the way, if we add this fifth Superior Court judge in Palmer, they would still be the busiest, have the highest caseload in the state, about what Anchorage has. So currently there are four judges, Superior Court judges, and we would like to add the fifth. It might be obvious, but the reason it is not ideal to have those judges with excessive caseloads is because it causes a ripple effect throughout the entire system. We still have to cover those cases. We are moving judges from other areas to cover all those filings, and there is a ripple effect that we're trying to stop administratively. It's just not a sustainable way that we've been handling those caseloads. I'll talk a little bit more about what we've done in just a moment. I want to say that the Palmer Court has not received new Superior Court judges since 2007. So 20 years ago is the last time they got additional Superior Court judges. During that 20 years, the population of the Matanuska-Susitna Valley has grown by, according to the Department of Labor, about 58%. Not surprisingly, the number of case filings since 2007 to today has grown about 56%. It goes hand in hand, as you can imagine. So those same four judges were handling 56% fewer cases in 2007. And this is something that we'd like to address. There are likely going to be other requests in the future for Superior Court judges in other areas. But right now, the Supreme Court has determined that Palmer is our most critical need and has, you know, instructed me to seek this one additional judge there. The case numbers themselves are fairly compelling, but I want to stress that it's not just case filing numbers that cause workload in the superior courts. Things have changed over the last 20 years in addition to the number of cases. Technology, of course, is the biggest change in the way that cases are handled. Cases take a lot longer now, with much more scientific evidence, much more electronic evidence, many more, for example, phone dumps, as they call them, where you might have thousands and thousands of pieces of paper or, you know, terabytes of information in a criminal case, and not just criminal cases. In family law cases where there's child custody or divorces at issue, judges very often have a lot of text message evidence that comes from the phones that they need to examine. Cases take longer. Things are more thorough scientifically and electronically, but that does add to the caseload. Another difference is in criminal cases is a change in victims' rights. This is fortunate that victims have more rights now than they did in 2006. Adding a victim to the people who are permitted to speak at certain hearings and submit documentation and work with the prosecutor is very good for the system, but it does sometimes mean more work for the entities involved. In child in need of aid cases, practices have changed from what it was 20 years ago. We now have one family, one judge. It's a best practice codified basically in 2017. So that a Superior Court judge, which handles domestic relations, family law, must also handle anything else that arises with that family. For example, if one of the children has a delinquency case, or there's a child in need of aid issue, or there's a domestic violence petition filed, those all now go to the Superior Court. They are bundled together with the same judge, which means that fewer issues other than emergencies can go to the magistrates or the lower courts for resolution. Again, a best practice, but changes the workload of the Superior Court judge. One more very important change in practice has been the rise in the number of self-represented litigants. This is not so much in criminal law, but particularly in family law. Our data shows that in child custody cases, about 70% of the parties of the cases have at least one self-represented party, and in divorces, at least half have a self-represented party. And, you know, this might be because lawyers have become much more expensive. People need to do these cases themselves for whatever reason. But without a lawyer, the case goes a bit slower. We need to provide the same level of access to justice to those individuals, but often those cases come with very frequent motions filed, arguments that are unrelated to the relevant legal issues. The parties may fail to submit required documentation so that child custody and asset division can be computed, and they are often not able to fully explain the legal basis for the arguments that they want to present. So the judge has to slow it down a little bit. So those are some of the changes that cause an increase in workload. I do want to say that we've been able to cover Palmer through several ways, but it's just not a sustainable thing. So we've tried everything. They've had the highest caseload for at least 6 to 8 years. And so what have we done? We have taken Anchorage judges and requested them to serve for a period of time in the Palmer Court. My understanding is, you know, to this day, when the presiding judge has his judge meetings in Anchorage, he says, can anyone give me some time to go up to Palmer? Can you take this trial? Can you take this case? And that has been happening. If an Anchorage judge, for example, has a trial fall off the calendar or has a cancellation, they might be willing to go up there, you know, not often, for 2 weeks. Their work is still coming in the Anchorage court. But when, you know, our presiding judge went up there to Palmer from Anchorage for two very long civil cases to be able to help out that court. But in the meantime, that does not stop case assignments from going to that Anchorage judge. So it affects that whole court as well. We've also tried taking the district court judges. There are three in Palmer, and temporarily assigning them to take certain superior court jurisdiction cases. That can work for a little while. Again, those district court judges still have their cases coming in. They have an average caseload, but there's only three of them. So if you eliminate one and move that person to superior court temporarily, those remaining two have a very excessive caseload. So again, it can be done for a short period of time, but not as a fix to the problem with the superior court. Third, we've engaged pro tem or retired judges to come back temporarily and fill in for the Palmer Superior Court. That happens most often with a particular trial. The retired judges can come back and handle, for example, a 4-week sexual assault trial or a 6-week homicide trial, because that is so time-consuming for the sitting judge to do. We've had some success with that. Retired judges are less willing to come back, say, for a 3-month stint and just do everything and act as a full-time judge. That also causes a ripple effect. We only have about 24 judges on what we call the pro tem list, and they are asked to fill in, say, in Bethel or in Kotzebue or in Kenai. So the more they're used in Palmer, the tougher it is to fill spots elsewhere. And also, those judges do get paid a daily rate, and we are not really funded to pay them for a very long term for sitting in one particular court. So those are the things we have tried. I also want to stress that all of these fixes have been a big administrative burden, and they have caused this ripple throughout the system. So this is not just a Palmer problem or not just a Mat-Su problem. That court serves everybody from, you know, Big Lake, Chickaloon, Willow, Kinnick, Wasilla, of course, and it's a bustling place. Our gate count shows about 5,000 people per month walk into that court, not all for Superior Court, of course. Some are posting bail or paying tickets, but it is a busy venue. I guess I'd just like to say that it's not just an issue that affects one area. It does affect the entire state and certainly Anchorage. We've also sent the Valdez judge up there. There are travel logistics with that, and, you know, she herself just had a 4-week homicide trial in Glen Allen, and she covers Cordova. So that judge is being pulled or asked to help out in Palmer as well. And for those reasons, we are seeking this new position. I'd be happy to take any questions or explain anything more fully if the committee wishes.
Thank you for that convincing presentation, Ms. Mead. We also have in the room Angie Kemp, the Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law, for questions. Do committee members have questions at this time? Senator Stedman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's quite a few criminals up there in that area of the state. Better there than in Southeast, I guess. But we want to help you with your courthouse. I think you need a place to put them. So could you... Mr. Chairman, can we have just a brief synopsis of where that is? Because that is another issue that we'll be dealing with at the table. physical location for this employee?
Ms. Mead.
Through the chair to Senator Stedman. As the committee is aware, we have had a request for funding, capital funding, to build out the Palmer Courthouse over the last several years. A couple years ago, we received one segment of that money, and last year we did not receive funds, and it became obvious that we needed to think outside the box. Some of the original money then we have used, are using, to remodel the courthouse to create one courtroom and the accompanying offices for what this position would be. This position itself does not need additional capital funds because we've used some of that $7 million to remodel space. The Palmer Courthouse also has the executive branch offices in it. Recently, the Department of Law vacated, actually I think it was Department of Corrections, a space in the basement. So that became available. So the court was able, is doing this currently. I don't mean to put it in past tense. Take some of that funding, remodel that downstairs space, and turn it into a grand jury courtroom. So moving the grand jury courtroom down, that freed up space on the main floor for a courtroom for this position and the accompanying positions that would sit with it. So this request for one judge does not require additional capital funding. We are, as the senator is stating, still seeking more capital funding for building that courthouse to accommodate additional judges. At the first point, it would have been building out three new courtrooms. Now that we can sort of jerry-rig, no pun, this courtroom, our remaining request for capital funds is for two more courtrooms. And as you can tell from the presentation about the population growth, we will be needing additional resources in Palmer. At this point, the court felt justified in seeking one because we can accommodate one. In the future, I suspect that the court will be seeking more.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an unrelated question. There's been a lot of discussion of a potential large capital project, a gas line going forward, and an infusion of 8,000 workers into the state, plus families and so on and so forth. Has the court given any consideration to what their needs may be with potential impacts? And I would just reference when we built TAPS, was a significant challenge in some of the communities, particularly Fairbanks and other areas where there was a high concentration of mobile workers and other folks that follow them from Nevada in particular.
Speed.
Through the chair to Senator Stedman, the Supreme Court follows somewhat issues such as how they will accommodate additional filings. The expectation is that more people working on a project like that may have quite an impact on the courts, Fairbanks, Palmer, Anchorage, maybe North Slope, I don't know. They closely monitor filings, try to predict what will happen based on the news and developments. And again, I suspect that I'll be back here in coming years to ask for additional resources should that lead to additional filings for the court system.
Senator Stedman. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. To the previous line of questioning about capital outlay, et cetera. And maybe it's better to wait until we look at the fiscal notes, but I was just wondering, is there anybody that we're missing in this? Because I note that it's legal. Is there additional capacity for bailiffs or any of the other support services that actually allow a courtroom to function that we might have missed in the preparation for the committee?
Ms. Mead.
To the chair, to Senator Kaufman. My fiscal note is how this will affect the court system. The agencies react to that according to their analysis of what this would cause for their entity. I wouldn't be able to speak to their fiscal notes, but the court system itself, when we get there, I can explain, does have a cost associated with this because it would be really four new positions.
Senator Coppin.
Thanks. I just want to be sure if we're considering this, we capture all of the immediate costs. We don't get hit with overtime charges for something in the future.
Further questions of Ms. Mead? Seeing none, we'll open the committee to public testimony. Is there, I don't see anyone online to testify on the legislation. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify at this time? With that, we'll close the public testimony. Senator Keel, can you review the fiscal notes, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 212 has a trio of fiscal notes. The first is from the judicial branch in the trial court's allocation. They have a first-year cost for fiscal year 2027 of $775.5 with four permanent full-time positions. When the one-time costs are backed out, the going-forward cost in 28 and beyond is $680,000. That covers the new judge, a judicial assistant, a judicial law clerk, and an in-court clerk. The second fiscal note is from the Department of Administration Public Defender Agency. They have put in a fiscal note requesting one permanent full-time attorney with a cost of $268,000. The third fiscal note keeps pace with that from the Department of Law in the criminal side, 3rd Judicial District. Apparently they have an allocation for outside Anchorage. That is for one attorney at a higher pay range at a cost of $305.5, so $305,500 in the first year, and then that becomes $303 going forward.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Are there questions from the committee on the fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand we may have someone on the phone from Department of Law. The Judiciary Committee grilled the public defender about his fiscal note. For the Department of Law, if memory serves, there's a $2 million increment request for the criminal side in the amendments we just got late last week. How does that overlap with the the $300,000 in this fiscal note, since they're both on the criminal side of the house?
Do we have Angie Kemp online?
You do. Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Keel, this is, for the record, Angie Kemp, Deputy Attorney General of the Department of Law. So to answer that question, the request for the Department of Law to increase for a supplemental and also to a government appropriation is based on rising case costs across the state. It's not particular to casework necessarily, but it's related to things like, for example, witness travel and the costs that we've seen grow exponentially over the last several years related to that. There's a number of core areas, but the highlights that when we're talking about the supplemental and the request for a further, for FY27 and other appropriations, and the $2 million is based upon those rising costs. But things like, for example, as I said, witness travel is a huge one. We've seen, I pulled out 2024 and 2019. I'm going a bit off memory here because I don't have my materials in front of me, but I pulled out 2 years in which we did the same amount of felony trials to try and illustrate how costs have increased exponentially. And when you compare those 2 years, the 2 years in which we did the identical amount of felony trials, you'll find that there was 122% increase in the cost that it cost us to try a felony trial as compared to the prior years. So all of these costs are things that are built into the essential work that we're doing, but are costs that we've not received increases for since 2008 was the last time that I was able to review the materials and identify that we had an appropriation specific to costs like that. So when I'm looking at the different issues here, the issues that you raised under appeal, and then this issue, when I think about this issue and the number of judges, it's not as much that I'm concerned that suddenly we're going to have an influx of additional Superior Court cases. My concern is, and I'll give you an analogy, if you've got two attorneys who work in an office and you've got two Superior Court judges, we know with some predictability we're going to have to be in two locations at any given time. Anytime a new judge is added to a location, that spreads attorneys out even further. So it changes our ability, for example, to be in the office and then doing the in-office casework that's also essential to our jobs. I think of it as essentially watering down our ability to be responsive to the to a other core function that we need to focus on. So just as Nancy Mead has described, there are certainly overlaps, like she described. We're certainly seeing an influx in digital discovery and changing really the landscape in casework that practically means it is critically important for our folks to also have that protected time in their offices. But again, adding another Superior Court judge and natural consequences is going to draw us out of the offices, because we won't be able to have as much of that in-person time. So I hope that that makes sense. I'm happy to answer any other questions about that.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Kemp, I appreciate the spreading argument. These judges spend some of their time on criminal cases, but they spend a lot of their time on civil and probate matters as well. So I think the committee may want to take a look at both of these fiscal notes. The other question I had about Department of Law's fiscal note is there any particular reason the Department of Law and the Department of and the Public Defender are paying these lawyers at different rates?
Ms. Kemp.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I don't know the answer to that. I didn't obviously participate in the public defender's analysis. When I look at the potential, though, that attorneys, if we're talking Superior Court attorneys, those are going to be the attorneys that are felony-level attorneys, largely. So they're going to be the ones that presumably are the more experienced, and as you can imagine, the more experienced attorneys tend to be ultimately paid at a higher rate. Sex assault prosecutors are an example of that. I think our asks have previously been for the same dollar amount to pay those folks, knowing that they're doing a very specific type of casework that is requires more experience, at least hopefully. The other thing that I will say specific to Palmer, Senator Keel, is that if folks in the committee recall, last year the Department of Law had made a request for an additional person in Palmer to deal with the rising caseloads on average were out of hand. That continues to be a problem in the Palmer office. I think the last time I looked and pulled an average out, it was roughly 230 cases per attorney in that office. Now, to caveat that, I'm not suggesting that that's all felonies that average makes up, but this was, again, something that was a concern last year, and if we double down on that by adding another Superior Court judge, it's only going to further exacerbate the pre-existing problem of rising caseloads unique to that office. And again, I'll just follow what Nancy Mead has said. This is an area of the state that's growing exponentially, and we've not, I don't think, necessarily kept pace with the growth that we're seeing out there.
Senator Keel.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chairman. We're under-resourced in a lot of agencies. I'm not going to argue that. Maybe we could get with OMB about, I'm pretty sure they're the same level of cases for the prosecutor and the defense attorney. So maybe the same cost for the two agencies makes more sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Do other members of the Finance Committee have questions on the fiscal note? Seeing none, do you have any closing comments, Ms. Mead?
No, thank you very much for considering the change to that statute. The Supreme Court appreciates that you provided a hearing.
Thank you. With that, we will be bringing this piece of legislation up at a later time, but at this point, we will set the bill aside, bring us to the last item for this morning, which would be Senate Bill 227, Tax Compact, Sales Tax, Oil and Gas Tax. This is the first hearing on the bill. I invite Senators Giesel and Senator Giesel and Senator Wilkowski to the table to introduce the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kathy Giesel, the Senator for District E in Anchorage. Mr. Chairman, thank you for hearing the bill. We're excited to present it. Mr. Chairman, this bill is a menu of revenue measures, Mr. Chairman. It partners very well with Senate Bill 274, which was introduced this week, which is a spending cap. So here we have a menu of new revenue sources. Some of them are actually not so new, Mr. Chairman. Some of these actually date back to 46 years ago. Now, three of us sitting at this table will recognize them because we paid some of them 46 years ago. But they were eliminated, and now we need to reconsider them. We also propose some new, modernized versions of them. The bill itself contains five elements. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to introduce three of them to you. Then Senator Wilkowski and his staff are going to deal with the other two elements. So this is version G, G as in Golovin. And I will start out by just giving an overview. We have in the bill a tax on highly digitized businesses. We have an S corporation tax. We have a modern education head tax. We have a 15-cent per barrel infrastructure surcharge on oil, and we have a gross production tax in this bill. A previous version of the bill, prior to the gross production tax, also included a hardening of the minimum tax floor, moving it from 4% to 6% and hardening it. And we had also, in a previous version, changed what's commonly called the slider, that is the deduction per barrel of oil, down from $8 down to $5. But those were eliminated in version G. So starting out with version G, first of all, the education head tax is proposed. This was in effect in our state up to 1980. Again, three of us sitting at this table were employees at that time and paid this. It was a flat tax taken out of every employee's first paycheck. What we're proposing here is that it would come out of the third and fourth paychecks of the year. And it's a bracketed education head tax, Mr. Chairman. Originally, back in the day, we paid $10 per person. This would bracket it. Less than $30,000 a year would have a $20 tax per year. So $10 theoretically out of the third paycheck of the year and another $10 out of the fourth. Then the bracket moves, as you can see, $30,000 to $90,000 would be a $30 per year tax, $90 to $150, and then above $150. The last bullet point points out that actually this type of tax initially began in 1919 here in Alaska, Mr. Chairman. So it's not a new idea at all. It's pretty commonly common bill or tax. We know that education financing is an important question that we're constantly dealing with, and you yourself, Mr. Chairman, have proposed creating an education fund. Next slide. We believe that the revenue generated, this estimate was created by Ben Goltz, my Dartmouth College intern, estimated about $11.5 million in income. You'll see in the fiscal note he was very close. They estimate 11 to 14 million per year. So that's the education head tax. The S corporation tax, Mr. Chairman, is one that I believe this committee has heard before. Also, right now C corporations are taxed through a corporate income tax. We follow the method that the federal government uses. And the federal government does not tax S corporations as the same type of entity as a C corp. They tax S corporations, which are privately owned with 100 or less employees, through the owner's income tax. Because Alaska has no income tax, S corporations are virtually tax-free in terms of corporate taxes. This bill would institute a tax on S corporation owners that matches C corporation taxes. Next slide. It would begin, again, this would close a loophole. 1980 is when we repealed our personal income tax. Next slide. So the S corporation tax would begin, again, it's bracketed, with a company making more than $1 million a year in net income. Next slide. Does the next slide have? I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, we are scrambling a bit on this. $1 million, less than $1 million a year in gross net revenue would pay zero. Above $1 million to $2 million a year would have a 5%. Corporate tax, 2 to $3 million would have a 6%, 3 to 4 would be 7, 4 to 5 would be 8%, and at 5 or more million would be the 9.4%. These can be found on pages 21 to 22 of the bill in front of you, again, version G, Golovin, section 4 of the bill. Next slide, please. And this is a hypothetical presentation of it. Next slide. Lastly, the piece I'm going to present to you is the 15-cent per barrel surcharge per barrel of oil going down taps. Mr. Chairman, this bill, 227, was originally proposed by Governor Dunleavy, and this piece was in the bill. This was preserved. We know that the Dalton Highway requires significant maintenance, Mr. Chairman, especially in the spring and fall when there's a lot of water and erosion issues. And this 15-cent surcharge, we in this bill indicate we want it, we intend for this to go toward the Dalton Highway maintenance, Mr. Chairman. This shows some of the anticipated income from it. At about $28.5 million, and this would go a long way toward maintaining that road. And those are the three elements of the bill I'm going to present, Mr. Chairman. I'll turn it over now to Senator Wilikowski and his staff.
Do we have any questions of Senator Giesel at this point? Senator Stedman.
On a couple different sections. School head tax. Can we go back to that slide, please? The school head tax with the dollar amount. And as I recall, wasn't the school head tax $100 at the time, back in the day when it was terminated? Could you help me with that, what it was?
Senator Stedman, it was $10 a day, but if you put it into inflation, it would be about $100 a day now.
Yeah, $100 per person, yeah.
Per person, you are correct. Per person, I'm sorry. Per person, yes. Yeah. It is true that that is not the high level that I'm proposing here. This obviously is before the committee. It is now your bill to amend as you wish. I went with lower amounts just sort of as a starter for discussions.
Senator Stedman.
No, that's fine. And then can we jump to the table on subchapter S?
Yes.
Because it went by so fast. And that, was there consideration of starting that number instead of at a million at a higher amount, or why did you select the starting rate at a million? And for those watching at home that aren't as familiar with subchapter S, it's taxed as normal income versus
yes.
a corporate income tax. It's just personal income. We have no personal income tax. Right? That's where the comment came with that. It's, you know, tax. There's no tax on it. But can you help me with that as why that wasn't? And then is there any idea how many companies might or how many people might fall into some of the upper brackets, the 10 million or the 25 million or the 6 million bracket?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Stedman. My original concept of the bill was starting at a net income of $5 million. I bracketed it to go lower through input from colleagues here in the Senate. You can see the comparison to the existing C-corps and what the S-corps would be paying comparably. You asked how many people would people, because this would be taxing the individual company owners, would fall into each bracket, and I cannot answer that question because that information is held confidential by the Department of Revenue. I can tell you that the indirect expenditure report from 2024 identified that there are approximately 11,700 companies that fall into the S-Corp or LLC category in our state. Where they would distribute in this income level, I can't tell you because that information is not publicly available to us.
Senator Stedman.
Okay. And I'm just curious on that because it makes it kind of makes it where we're flying blind. How do we get that data to have a discussion on these rates, or do we do what they do in Washington, pass the bill, and then find out what's in it?
Senator in Washington, D.C., Mr. Chairman, in response to that question, essentially that would somewhat answer the question. I can tell you that in the Spring Revenue Sources book for this year, petroleum corporate revenue taxes brings in $160 million. It's projected in the spring forecast to be $210 million for FY27. So this S corporation tax would apply to any companies who are producing or transporting oil and gas. I believe we can probably name some companies on the slope that are producing throughout the state, actually, who are producing oil. We know that the potential builder of a gas pipeline is also an S corporation. So it could amount to a substantial amount of additional revenue, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stedman.
Senator Stedman. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Any further questions of Senator Giesel? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. To Senator Giesel on that last topic, transporting, could that include, a business transporting fuel oil to people's houses? Would they be considered in the business of transporting hydrocarbons?
Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kaufman, no, they are not considered transporting.
Senator Kaufman.
Can you explain why that's not so?
Senator Giesel.
The bill is intended, if it's not specific enough, it could be modified to be, that this would be via pipelines, pipelines or other substantial transportation. I'd have to, I'm sorry, I can't answer the question at the moment.
We can delve into that further. Senator Kaufman.
On the other topic of what's being called the education tax, if we could go back, was stated to be a head tax, but it has progressivity in it. That's hard to say in the morning. It looks like a progressive income tax. And so head taxes, and we're on the wrong slide now, but the other slide that showed that table, I'm just curious if it's a head tax, why is it, when I think of a charging by the head, it's if you're going in a movie theater, you pay whatever the price of a theater is now, $10 a head, or it's probably 15 or something these days. And so that's kind of a head toll. But they don't charge me to go into the theater on the basis of how much income I've made. So could you just explain how the progressivity correlates with anything that's properly defined as a head tax?
Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 27 of version G is chapter 45. It says education tax. That's what's officially in the bill. I apologize for the error on the slide, which refers to it as a head tax.
Thank you, Senator Geisel. Senator Kaufman.
Now that we're calling it an education tax, is there a mechanism in this that actually directs this, whatever revenues directly to education?
Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because we can't designate funds, there is only intent language. However, this committee's chairman had the vision for an education fund, and this bill could certainly be amended to direct the money into that fund.
Thank you, Senator Geisel. Senator Kaufman?
Thank you. So as it stands, it's up there at least, it's called a head tax, but it's actually a progressive income tax. And it's called an education tax, but it doesn't actually direct funds directly to an education account. It goes into the general fund. And as I understand, we haven't gotten to the fiscal note yet, but the fiscal note describes tremendous infrastructure to be built for tax accounting, for assessing people's income. So it looks, for all the world, like the framework for a progressive income tax that's being called, at least sometimes casually, an education head tax that isn't actually directed towards an education fund at the present time. And it's got all the hallmarks of a progressive income tax. So I just want to be sure that we're letting folks that might be listening and watching know exactly what we have here as it's currently being presented in this bill.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Further questions of Senator Geisel at this point? Senator Stedman.
Just for clarity, I can't remember. I'm sure I paid that education tax in the day. But it was just a set flat amount and no income requirement? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman, that is correct. However, I have reluctance in assessing folks making less than $30,000 a year the same amount as someone making more than $150,000 a year. In addition, Senator Stedman, Mr. Chairman, we have approximately 25% of the working people in the state of Alaska who don't live here. This is all revenue that is being put into their paychecks and leaving our state, where they pay taxes in another state that support their schools. This is a small piece coming out of those paychecks to pay for Alaska's school education system. If projects go forward as are being envisioned, that number of out-of-state employees, non-resident employees, is going to mushroom, just like it did during TAPS. Three of us were here, working people, during those years of TAPS construction. We know how many people were here. We paid an income tax at the time, and we paid an education tax. That's what I'm trying to envision for the future, Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman, members of the committee.
Senator Stedman.
This is a follow-up. I think I'd be just kind of interested. If we had a $100 flat head tax for everybody that has an income over $30,000, what that would look like, if at all possible, in the thoughts. I don't disagree with Senator Kaufman. The appearance of a income tax structure is pretty close.
Hey, we get that information for the committee. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess we should probably just think a little bit about what things are and what they aren't. Would an income tax apply to only the first two checks, or would an income tax apply to a person's income?
It's in this bill, it's proposed only to the third and the fourth paychecks. Originally, of course, it was on our first paycheck. That's all.
So, thank you. Would a progressive income tax raise more total dollars from someone with an income of $250,000 a year than $151,000 a year?
Well, I would suppose so, Mr. Chairman, Senator Keel.
Okay, so we're not, in fact, talking about a progressive income tax at all. We're talking about it's kind of tax with a variable rate. But clearly we're talking about a capitated tax and not a progressive income tax at all. That's helpful. Thank you for clearing that.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Further questions? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. I just want to double check. So we're talking about only earned income, so that would be W-2 or self-employed income as currently envisioned. Is this including folks on Social Security or living off of savings?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kaufman, that is correct. These come out of paychecks, self-employed as well as the average employee.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Senator Stedman.
Just one cautionary note, Mr. Chairman, and plugging another issue we're working here, that I think when we look at vehicle car rental tax, that was supposed to be directed to marketing, and that gets side-channeled quite often. This could very well be the same situation. So just food for thought with the other concept that the committee's looking at, giving the public the opportunity to dedicate funds that would then be directed, if something like this was tied to that or something else. But in the event it's just designated or inferred in the legislation, it would be an ongoing discussion at the table every year, because there might be other ideas to spend the revenue on.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Further questions? Senator Keel.
Just a little mechanical question about how this works. A lot of folks work seasonally, different jobs through the year. So if the third and fourth paycheck of the year come January or February, and then somebody switches jobs and works a summer job, does it get taken out and then refunded? Do they tell the employer? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Keel, there's provision for reimbursement of if it's levied multiple times inappropriately. Yes, there are provisions for refunding.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. We'll move forward to hear from Senator Wilikowski. Thank you, Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator for East Anchorage, and I'm joined by David Dunsmore and Sonia Kawasaki. I want to talk about two provisions. I don't have a PowerPoint, but I will talk about these two items. The first one is a change to the oil tax structure. We've been told for many years by many of our consultants that we have the most complex oil tax structure in the world, and we have a system now that has tax credits, gross value reductions, carry forwards, provisions that allow the industry to potentially drive their tax rate to 0%. We have the Willow Project, a project that every one of us supported a number of years ago, is on federal land, and that is a project that is estimated to be costing the people of Alaska between $250 million and $300 million per year, possibly more, because the company gets to write off all of their expenses off of their Alaska production taxes, even though we ultimately, when it goes into production, we receive no royalties on that. We receive no royalties because it's on federal land, NPRA. And then the production taxes, because it's on also a new developed project, federal land, the gross value reduction applies. That's another provision that is in our current law, which allows companies to drive their tax rate down to potentially zero. We've been told by the Department of Revenue, you've been told by the Department of Revenue, that 40% of the new oil going forward in the future, not immediately, but it's kicking in over the next few years, roughly 40% of the new oil will be under this gross value reduction provision, which will potentially drive the tax rate down to zero. And we can see the impacts of our tax structure by just simply looking at the 2026, and this is the fall revenue forecast, but you can see we had $9.5 billion of taxable barrels. This is the 2026 fall forecast, $9.5 billion worth of oil going through the pipeline, for which under the fall forecast, and I know it's been changed under the spring forecast, but I think it's still illustrative of the impacts. We were projected to receive $323.5 million in production taxes. That is a tax rate of 3.3%. We have a gross floor of 4%, but we're not receiving even the gross floor. We're receiving lower than that under our fall forecast projections. And so we have a system that is extremely complex, is not getting us what we were promised, and is quite frankly costing us huge amounts of money. And a lot of promises were made by the industry to get this system, Mr. Chairman. You all remember them. The public all remembers them because we had two attempts by the citizens to reverse this. We had one was a referendum and one was a citizens' initiative. And in the first one, we were told we were going to get more jobs and more oil, and it was going to be good for Alaska. And instead, we've lost billions of dollars. The peak of jobs occurred in August of 2014, which was coincidentally the month of the initiative, or the referendum, where the people tried to overturn the oil tax changes in Senate Bill 21. And 15,300 jobs at that point, 15,300 jobs in August of 2014. Where are we today? We're at about 9,000 jobs. And the industry is actually celebrating because that's an increase of a couple thousand jobs from where we were just a few years ago, 9,000 jobs. And 40% of those jobs, according to the Department of Labor, are not Alaskan residents. 40% of the jobs, not Alaska residents. So that means we've got roughly 5,400 Alaskans who are working in the industry. And for that, we're giving hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks every single year. We're going to get 3.3% gross value tax. This is far lower than I would venture to guess any oil jurisdiction in the world gets for their oil, Mr. Chairman. And so the question that we've struggled with for years as a state is, well, what is getting the maximum value for our resource? That's what the Constitution tells us is our obligation. People talk about, well, we should get our fair share. Actually, that's not the standard. The standard is that we get the maximum value for our resource. That's what the Constitution tells us we need to do. And so we've wrestled with that concept for many years. And so what we've done with this bill is we've gone to a gross tax, and we looked at, well, what do they do in Texas, North Dakota, which is some place that we've always been compared to. We've looked at what we've historically gotten for years, for decades, actually. We had a 12.5% gross. What this amendment and what this bill does is goes to a 17.5% gross. How did we get 17.5% gross? Which, by the way, we currently have a 35% net tax. This goes to a 17.5% gross tax. And so we looked at a few things. Number one, we looked at, well, what did Governor Hammond say? We've all heard Governor Hammond famously said it should be a third, a third, a third. And right now, by our calculations, we're getting roughly 16% of the gross value of the oil. How do we figure that
number out? Can you explain where those thirds go to under Hammond's?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Governor Hammond and has very famously said, we've heard it repeated over the years, a third of the value of the oil should go to the industry, a third should go to the federal government, and a third should go to the people of Alaska, the state of Alaska. And so our share, and so the federal government unilaterally took a lower share when they cut their corporate income taxes from 35% to 21%. That's their prerogative. That boosted the amount that went to the oil industry. The state of Alaska, we, under Senate Bill 21, we went ahead and reduced our share of the taxes from roughly 28% historically, which is where we were, and 37% during ACEs, down to the current level, which is about 16.5%. How do we figure that number? Well, you look at the royalties. Our royalties are about 12.5%, but we don't actually get 12.5% because the industry gets to write off a percent for transportation costs and other costs. So that brings it down to about 11% or so. We get a 3.34% of value on top of that of production taxes, a very small percent, a fraction for corporate income taxes and a fraction for property taxes, and it gets us to about 16%. So historically, for decades, we were at 28%. Under ACEs, we were at 37%. This brings us, and so we said, you know what, how do we get close to that? And so we said, well, let's add a 17.5% gross tax. When you add that onto our 12.5% royalty, it gets us to roughly 30%. It's actually a little bit less than that, but roughly 30%. How does that compare us to Texas and North Dakota? Well, the big difference is royalties in those states. Texas and North Dakota, both on federal, on state lands, the royalties 25% generally. Some places it's higher. So you've got a 25% gross right there, which is much higher than our royalty. Then you factor in the other taxes, which they have gross taxes already. We're the only state in the country that has net taxes. North Dakota has a combined gross tax of around 10%. Texas has a tax of around 5.6%. So both of those are in the 25 to 30% range. And so this puts us right around where those other states are. When you get into other countries, you're dealing with net taxes. You're in Norway with a 78% net tax. You're dealing with Iraq with a 99% tax. You look at countries like Venezuela and Russia. You're talking 90% net tax. We're not doing anything like that. We're simply saying 17.5% gross tax. That's what this amendment does. It keeps it simple. The flaws have been exposed on our net profits tax. You know, for decades, we had a gross tax, and we developed taps with a gross tax, and we produced 2 million barrels of oil with a gross tax, and it was 12.5%. This is a little bit higher than that. Maybe the committee decides they want to adjust the number downward a little bit. Maybe you want to adjust the number a little bit downward for new fields, which is something that I think the committee should consider. But for the legacy fields, the fields like Prudhoe, Kuparuk, Alpine, there is absolutely no reason not to have a tax of, I would say, 17.5%. Those fields are making huge amounts of profits. And, you know, the industry, again, made a lot of promises to get these tax breaks. This was just from a couple years ago. Vote no for tax increases, and you're going to save jobs and save the PFD. The PFD is not saved. The people of Alaska understand that. In fact, the cuts to oil taxes are the reason why PFDs are being cut. That is a direct correlation between why the PFDs have been cut is because we are getting so little for the value of our oil. Oil used to fund 90% of our government. It now funds 23% of our government. And that has to be made up somewhere. And that's why we're wrestling with all these things. Governor Dunleavy's proposal was the sales tax. That was soundly rejected by the people of Alaska and many members in this body. And so this would go to a gross tax. The flaws are so great under our current net tax structure. We have issues with auditing. We know that, we knew this. We knew this. This was a big fight. I know there's a number of members here when we went to the net, and this was the big fight, going to a net profits tax, because we knew we couldn't keep up with the accountants and the tax attorneys that the industry had. We've got the best in the world. We simply can't keep up. And so taking it to a gross tax simplifies things, gets rid of all these tax breaks, tax deductions, tax credits, GVRs, and makes it one simple, easy to understand structure easy for the industry, easy for the people of Alaska. easy for our government to administer. And we think this is something that would benefit the people of Alaska and benefit our revenue stream as well. And that's all I have to say on that, Mr. Chairman. On the internet, I'll call it the highly digitized provision.
Before you proceed, what would the percentage of from 17.5% be reduced to on the gross tax to get the revenue that we're receiving today? Do you have that calculation?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Whatever we're receiving under the present tax structure.
Yeah,
what percentage of the gross would we put in place to receive equivalent amount of revenue that we're receiving today?
What we're getting right now, based on the fall forecast, we are getting a gross tax of about 3.3%.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, on the highly digitized provision, it's a technical provision. This was something that actually the governor had proposed a number of years ago through his revenue commissioner. Alaska is one of only a few states that has not changed our apportionment structure, the way we deal with internet taxes, internet sales predominantly. And fundamentally what happens is when we set up our corporate income tax structure, and this, by the way, only applies to C corporations, large corporations in general. If you go into a store and you buy something in Alaska, and it's a C corporation, the sale occurs in Alaska. It's easy to calculate what the corporate income tax, the sale occurs there. If you buy it on the internet, this is where you get into problems. And this was not something that was contemplated when our corporate income apportionment laws were written decades ago, because you didn't have the internet back then. If you buy something on the internet, something very different happens. It gives the corporations that you buy from the ability to say, well, the sale didn't really occur in Alaska. Maybe it occurred at a server farm in California. Maybe it occurred at the corporate headquarters somewhere else. And so what this has led to is Alaska being deprived of corporate income taxes. Now, I want to emphasize this provision has passed this body. It passed the other body. It was vetoed by the governor. It passed overwhelmingly, a bipartisan measure, by the way. It doesn't increase taxes at all. It doesn't impact Alaska businesses. It actually positively impacts Alaska businesses because it puts them on a more level footing. Right now, you're at a disadvantage if you're an Alaska brick-and-mortar building, a brick-and-mortar corporation, because you're paying the corporate income tax, and you've got to compete with someone who's using your Alaska ports and Alaska broadband and Alaska court system, possibly, and Alaska police and fire protection, possibly, and yet not paying anything. And the Alaska businesses, it does have to pay that under our current structure. And so this is something that 36 other states have done, and it does not raise corporate taxes at all. It just simply changes where the sale occurs. In fact, we've been told by the Department of Revenue that it's estimated that a large percentage of the money that we would receive under this provision would not result in a new tax to a company, but would rather result in the taxes that are already being paid to other states being shifted to Alaska. In other words, companies are paying these taxes to other states, and instead of paying a tax to California, these companies would start paying this tax to Alaska. And so it wouldn't result in it. We've been told by the Department of Revenue, new taxes for many of these organizations that would be affected by this. For the specifics and technicalities, I can turn that over to my staff if you have questions, Mr. Chairman, but I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Do members of the Finance Committee have members of questions for Senator Wilkowski? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things. I think it gets confusing when we get into the oil tax discussion because we've got the net back, which is subtracting the cost of the pipeline and water transportation to market, and then we have our royalties, and then you end up with this what we call the gross value point of production, and I think that's the point at which this calculation is made, is at the gross value point of production. Again, that's after transportation and royalties. And then we have expenditures, operating and capital. So I think when you look at the one-third, 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 that comes up quite a bit, and I don't really buy into that personally, but beside the point, one-third, one-third, one-third would be on the profit oil or after expenditures. It wouldn't be on the gross. And that would, you know, one-third of that is about 60 or 33%. You got to double that, of course, if you're going to take the federal government on one-third, one-third. But the federal government doesn't really get a whole third, right? So we don't want to use – if we're going to do that mental math, we want to make sure that we get a little more than one-third because of the reduction. And same with the industry, the reduction that the federal government gets because they don't get a whole third. With that being said, and then I think on the royalties, I think that is correct. The royalties in Dakotas and Texas and other areas are higher than our royalties. They're owned by the subsurface is owned by private landowners, farmers, ranchers, what have you. Our royalties, and royalties are by contract. Royalties, the vast majority of our royalty revenue, the 12 and an eighth or so, are royalty contracts that are decades old. Go back and maybe even into the 60s when we first opened the field. So time has evolved and royalties today are different than that. And that is somewhat adjusted with the newer oil with it, a 16%+ royalty. So there's some adjustment there. And then we have our severance tax, which is on the net profits. And that's the point of the tax that we're talking about that can adjust for these different variations over time. And try to keep us competitive so we can get to our marginal fields. So there's some of those nuances. It would be interesting, as just an exercise, to take that half of the 35% tax rate, which is basically 17 or so, and put it on the gross value point of production, which would be after expenditures. After operating and capital expenditures, just to see what that looks like. And I would agree that we have the most complicated tax structure, or one of the most, I would say one of the most, if not the most, on the planet, to the point where we confuse ourselves and frankly, we're always going to be at a disadvantage with the industry because of the ability of the accounting and knowledge of the accounting and the tax attorneys, and we're always playing catch up. And we have audit provisions and stuff like that to help with that. So that's just some of the nuances. It'd be nice. I think the Department of Revenue might be able to help with quick calculation on some of this stuff. I'd also like to note, Mr. Chairman, we have a group of consultants that work for us that could help with some of these issues. But the complexity, I think, and transparency, you know, could use some improvement. There's no doubt about that. So that would alleviate some of the misunderstandings between the two partners, which is the industry and ourselves, because we are either going to sink or swim, or we're going to sink or swim together. There's no, you know, we can't harvest the oil, and they can't do it without us. So we gotta work on that. But anyway, with that, just some brief comments, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senators Wilkowski.
Oh, just to respond to that, Mr. Chairman, I great points. Agree with those completely. We've been told by consultants numerous times, Rick Ruggiero from Gaffney Klein, others from Gaffney Klein have told us we have one of the most, or rather, the least transparent oil tax systems in the world. We're making decisions, and if you were to ask the Commissioner of Revenue or any producer how much profit they made, they would not tell you. The Commissioner of Revenue would not tell you how much profit a particular company made. They would not tell you what their rate of return is. They would not tell you what their net present value is. And these are all critical things to determining what is a fair oil tax structure. On your...
Can you explain why they won't tell us?
I have... Well, I can just go back to when we were doing ACES, Mr. Chairman, back in 2007, and we asked these exact questions because industry was telling us if you pass ACES, it was going to make us less competitive, it was going to make us less profitable, it was going to mean they were going to leave the state. And we asked those exact questions. I asked those questions. Many asked those questions. What's your net present value? What's your rate of return? How much profit are you making? Everyone once I had an Exxon executive refused to tell how much profit they made in Alaska. So they didn't even keep that information. And so we actually hired Gaffney and Klein back in 2007 to figure out what the rate of return was at Prudhoe Bay under the tax structure that we were proposing. And we told them to increase the capex and opex by 200%. And the rate of return at Prudhoe Bay back then was 123%. Now, that's why they don't want to tell you. That's why they don't want to tell you. They'd rather come in and say, oh, if you do this, we're going to leave. Or if you do this, we're not going to be competitive. They don't want you to know the numbers, quite frankly. Because if you know the numbers, quite frankly, we'd be getting a heck of a lot more. And just to answer Senator Stedman's question on how much more we'd be getting with a 17.5% at the gross value point of production, that's the beauty of the gross tax. You can just plug it in. I just did it on my iPhone. And the gross value in 2027, it's $8.494 billion that is the gross value point of production. And then for that, we're getting under our existing law, $293 million in taxes. $293 million in taxes. That's a couple percentage points. If you had a 17.5% of the gross, you'd be getting $1.48 billion. That just goes to show you how little we are getting. 17.5% of the gross gets you $1.48 billion. That's a $1.2 billion more than we're currently getting. We're losing roughly at least $1 billion a year. We've had years, and now with oil prices going up, we're probably losing billions per year we're losing. And what does that mean for the people of Alaska? Well, that means you get a smaller PFD. That means you get less money for education funding. That means you have less money for everything that we need in this state, infrastructure projects, schools that are falling. You know, they're building islands in the Middle East with their oil money. Building islands in the ocean and putting huge office complexes and incredible new developments. And here we are in Alaska. We have schools falling in the ocean because we're giving our resources away.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. We just, in committee, were presented with some interesting modeling that was showing relatively low IRR rates, so 13 and change, so quite low compared to what was just discussed. So it would be interesting if we could perhaps get similar modeling on IRR in reference states such as Texas. I don't know if that's possible, but the rate of return for the companies doing the work is what really generates their interest in production. So I think there's what we take, but then there's also the rate of return that enables continued activity and avoids, pushing it out or not enabling it. And I know every time we talk about a tax that's meant to inhibit behavior, like a consumption tax, an alcohol tax, cigarette tax, the goal of the taxation is to inhibit it. So I want to be sure that that's not a side product, a byproduct of any changes that we would make. The last thing we need to do is somehow inhibit activity, but we do need to make sure that we're getting a reasonable share of the revenue combined, and that's taxes and royalties.
Comment, Senator Wilkowski.
Yes, absolutely, Senator Kaufman. I would agree completely through the chair. And curiously, we by lowering taxes, development was inhibited. We were promised, or rather, a goal was set, multiple goals were set, that we would get 1 million barrels a day within 10 years. 1 million barrels a day. We're less than half that now, Mr. Chairman. Oil production has declined. Now it's going up, but the interesting thing is we're told it's going up, but the interesting thing is we're getting nothing for it. Look at the revenue forecast going out forward. We get nothing for it. Our revenue stream is actually declining going forward. So we're getting less revenue. We've dropped from 15,300 jobs to about 9,000 jobs, 40% of which are not going to Alaska. A few years ago at Prudhoe Bay, one of the companies, spent about $150 million in investment in Prudhoe Bay, and they got $720 million in tax credits for that. Now, I would say if you're a business person and you are saying, well, we're going to give you $720 million for a $150 million investment, that's probably not the best investment. That's probably not the best way you want to spend your money. I would say that when you look at the, every quarter we ask the nonpartisan Legislative Research Department to evaluate ConocoPhillips SEC reports, and we find out every quarter for the last 20 years, just about almost every quarter, the most profitable oil jurisdiction in the world for ConocoPhillips is the state of Alaska. And it's not even close most quarters. So, yes, we are very profitable. We absolutely do not want to do anything to inhibit development, to inhibit future investment. I don't think we're doing that. I think we have over-incentivized. We've made a complicated system, and we're not following our constitutional obligation to get the maximum value for the resource. We're not doing that.
Senator Sedman.
Just a couple points. I think on the earlier conversation on information from the industry and the inability, which is true, the inability for us to know the rates of return or how close our policies are to what we want them to be or projected them to be is an issue. But we got to remember we did that to ourselves. We put the transparency restrictions in our own statutes. We block the ability of the Department of Revenue to tell us. So we get our revenue source book, Mr. Chairman. That's an amalgamation of all producers, and we get one number for production, pretty much, one oil price, one cost price, one operating, one capital. And we know all the companies are different. They're different capital structures and so on and so forth. But we have to use a consolidated numeric. So there's always going to be companies that are doing better or doing worse. And then if there's three majors, we'll probably, one will get the short end of the stick, one will come out on top, and one might, we might be right in the middle of that one. So, but we do that to ourselves. And to the point when Point Thompson was going forward and there was billions in credits going in, we couldn't even get the department to tell us the dollars of the credits, and they were in the billions on Point Thompson. We could ask, frankly, Exxon, and they would tell us within a pretty close range what is actually going on. Our own department couldn't tell us. We had to go to the industry and ask them. That's just goofy, right? And the companies were pretty forthright of what was being spent and the credits and how things were going up there. And frankly, it was a money loser for the state for years, might still be, because of the cost. And, when we look at our net investment and the high tariff, getting the product back to Pump Station 1, eventually it'll be a very profitable field, Point Thompson, for gas and stuff. But we forced the industry to move forward with that at our own expense. So I can't fault them. They have to keep their leases because they're very, very, very valuable. On the, another cautionary note, when we look at North Dakota and Texas, the Permian Basin and stuff, they deal with shale oil, a lot of fracking, which opened up maybe, pushing 15 years ago now or so, where we have the largest conventional oil field in North America on the slope. So their fields are different. So you've got to have some adjustments. And there's cost differences and so on and so forth, and life cycle differences as far as how quick in shale, the volume declines a lot faster than they do in the Alaska wells, generally speaking. So we've got to have some adjustments in how we look at it when we set our rates. But those are just a couple of points, Mr. Chairman. It does get very complicated. There's no doubt about it. But there's also no doubt that Alaska is a profitable place to do business. That's why we have the expansion going on. I think we want to keep that expansion. But there is a concern that if oil production goes up and revenue goes down, which is what the forecasts are for us, that's going to be a hard issue for the legislature and the industry to reconcile with the public. And I think that's represented in the revenue source book. I've been pointed out by the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. The reason that we have this piece of legislation before us is we look at the current year that we're in, FY 2026. I would say that the current governor is probably one of the more conservative governors that I've seen in 20 years. But we had passed legislation last year on the operating budget we thought was balanced. As it turns out, the governor came forward with a supplemental and is still adding to that supplemental today. That supplemental was approximately $530 million. Of that, there was $130 million that was borrowed from the higher ed fund. So the current budget that we're in had approximately $400 million in deficits. As I said before at this table, we are being bailed out, I believe, on a short-term basis by higher oil prices. That remains to be seen. We're still considering ways to address that deficit, but the price of oil, even the president says, is going to be coming down. We are living in a situation where we are potentially balancing our current budget of FY 2026 and our budget for 2027 on borrowed time. We need to, if we want to continue to provide the services that we're providing today, we need to come up with a long-term solution. If it's not this particular piece of legislation, what is it? I think everyone in the building realizes that. I think the administration realizes that because being as conservative as they are coming forward with very little, if any, additional reductions. People say that we've cut government to the bone, and I would possibly concur with that. So we're at a point in our history of our state that if we want, as I said, if we want to come up with additional revenues, we need to take some action. This is a proposal. It's available for modifications. Both finance committees, I think, have the responsibility to come up with something that resembles a long-term solution. People have put caveats saying I'm not going to vote for additional revenue unless I get, spending cap or X, Y, and Z. Then we need to have a complete package. In my experience, when you demand a complete package, everything collapses. So we need to take steps, whatever they may be, to go forward. If it means addressing our tax structure, if we are even able to accomplish that one one issue so that we understand it better. And if we go to a gross tax and leave it at 3.5%, at least that clarifies the tax structure that we have. That may not be something that we can get accomplished, but something needs to come forward for our state to move ahead. And I think it's incumbent upon us to do that if we want to adequately represent the constituents that have come accustomed to where we are. One other final note, education. It seems to be a high priority to people of this state, but when you have even the numbers that I've given earlier, you have the largest school district in the state of Alaska facing a $90 million shortfall. These are future leaders that we are talking about, and somehow we need to address that as well. So we're not going to reduce the BSA. We're talking about, and the current system, the base student allocation, isn't adequate to address the needs of our students. So that's why I think the Education Committee is coming up with what they feel is a recommendation to change that BSA, and that is going to cost additional dollars above and beyond the $400 million that I see as an ongoing shortfall. So with that, do we have any additional questions of Senator Wilkowski at this time? Senator Wilkowski, do you have any closing comments before we set this bill aside?
I don't, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we'll set this bill aside. This afternoon, we are going to be addressing at 1:30 legislative finance is going to come before the committee to provide an update on the three-year outlook for the model for the POMV step-down as proposed by this committee in Senate Bill 274. And the next item will be provide an overview of the school major maintenance and school bond indebtedness, which is another major cost to the state that I didn't even mention. With that, we are adjourned until then.